This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 8th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 359. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, if you watched a supper hour newscast on TV in BC since 1976, chances are you saw Mike McArdle, a reporter who told extraordinary stories about everyday people. I spoke with him on August 30th, the day he retired. Mike McArdle is my guest on this week's edition. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. A reporter's reporter, a storyteller like no other in British Columbia. He is now retired. Mike McArdle delivered his final last word report on the August 30th edition of CTV News Vancouver at 6. Mike is now 80. On that final report, recorded at the P&E Fair, he said he can't get up and downstairs like he used to, and it's harder to tell the stories since his wife of 58 years, Valerie, died back in May. After cutting his teeth as a crime reporter in New York, he came with his family to the West Coast in 1973 to work for the Vancouver Sun. 3 years later, he joined BCTV, known today as Global. It was one of North America's top-rated local news stations. He told thousands and thousands of stories, in print and on TV. McArdle also authored 13 books from Harbor Publishing and available at libraries and bookstores around BC. One way to remember him, he said, is to simply meet people, share a conversation, and tell the story about that around the dinner table. I spoke with Mike McArdle on August 30th. Here are highlights of the interview.
How do I feel? I feel sad. I feel very, very sad because the highlight of my everyday was finding somebody, being with a camera person. They are all good, and they sometimes wake me up and say, look at that dude over there, you know, the lovable, strange person. And I talk to that person, and if there is something in there, if I can find something, there's always something there, but I can't always find it. But if I hear them talk about whatever, you know, they did this when they were 3 years old, their grandmother taught them everything, they have a collection of worms, they have these flowers because they're going to see somebody who's sick and in the hospital. And then that becomes a story. And very simply, then when there's enough of the story, then I go back and put pieces together with an editor who I've never met a bad editor. I met some great ones. But, and they, you know, say, why don't, you know, let's start with this. I say, let's start with that. And they say, no, this. And the editor gets her way or his way. And that's a highlight. That's a great life. Except I can't do it anymore because I'm too tired.
You have told stories for 62 years in the business. Started out in New York, where you're from, in print. You know, being a crime reporter in the Big Apple, couldn't be a better place to really cut your teeth in journalism and learn how to tell stories.
Yeah, I was lucky. I failed everything in high school. I have trouble reading, literally, seriously. I can't read a whole long sentence without forgetting what at the end of it, what was at the beginning. My wife used to hide the old report card she found where every single subject had a red circle on it, and it was failed. I could see the daily, this teacher would bring in the Daily News, which was a big time tabloid, but they wrote stories only about crime, corruption, sex, violence. And I could read I could get through the headlines, and they had lots of pictures, New York picture newspaper. And I thought, boy, I'd like to meet those people, the criminals and the crazy people and the wonderful people and the heroes. And so I told my mother one day in the middle of February. They told everybody in the class, okay, you're done. Oh, go away. you know, do we graduate? Yeah, we'll talk about that later. My mother said, go to a newspaper. So I went to the New York Times, because that was the Times Square, and that's where the subway stopped. And they offered me a job as an outdoor messenger. And it was cold. It's February, New York. It's like Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal. It's cold. I walked across town and just accidentally stood in front of the New York Daily News. And I could read that. I went inside, and they offered me a job as an indoor messenger. So I took that and stayed there more than 10 years, actually 12, 13 years, whatever it was. And I went from the mail room up to the city room, and I walked in there, and it was like, it was heaven. It was the city room, the newsroom that Hollywood based everything on. Not that one. Every single one in the world was like that. The manual typer, it's going click, click, click. People yelling, copy boy, or copy, you know, get my stuff. And somebody yelling, how many dead? And phones ringing and noisy. And everybody seemed to be smoking and drinking. paper containers, one quart, big ones. Of beer on almost every desk, and every drawer had whiskey in it. And that was, you know, just the way it was. And I said, I never want to leave this. It was wonderful.
The late 1960s and early 1970s, it was a great time to be a crime reporter in New York City, but a dangerous time to be a New Yorker. Mike said that his wife Valerie had to use her body to protect their two children in a playground during a gunfight. Mike himself was violently beaten by thugs and even shot at. He learned about Vancouver in National Geographic. It looked beautiful.
I didn't know where Vancouver was. I hardly know, I'm American. I hardly knew what Canada was. I knew it was west of Montreal. I knew Montreal was north of New York. I rented a U-Haul truck for 3 days. Three. I figured one day to Montreal, one day west, find an apartment, unload the truck, the third day return the truck. Motors running in New York City. An uncle of my wife's came to say goodbye and gave me one of those Automobile Association maps that fold out like an accordion, and I handed it to our son, who gave it to his sister, who gave it to her mother.
Mike and his family lived in a tent in White Rock temporarily while he worked for the Vancouver Sun, and while Valerie went looking for an apartment, they eventually found a place to live in North Vancouver. Mike's beat was the Vancouver Police headquarters at 312 Main Street. Another reporter there, Alan Edwards from BCTV, suggested he talk to his boss about reporting for TV. Mike went to work for BCTV in 1976 and was there for 38 years until a management shakeup in 2013 when it was known as Global. CTV picked him up pretty quickly. Looking back at his career, though, one story that stands out among others was the deadly September 1971 Attica prison riot in New York. 33 prisoners and 10 guards were killed.
Waiting outside the prison, a cop comes over and says, prisoners want to talk to somebody. Who wants to go? I said, the photographer says, I don't. They open the first doors, close. We walked in, they closed them, open the inner door, and oh God, I'm in a rioting prison. And first thing is, all the prisoners had towels wrapped around their faces and heads for protection. And brooms, sharpened broomsticks, and pointed them at my eyes. said, just follow us. And the photographer only take a picture when he's told to talk to the hostages. They had some prison guards that were hostages. And I know what hell is like, because that was hell. First the smoke, then the stink, then the screams, the catwalks, which are terrifying to be on, but even more so when they got somebody in front of you and behind you with a sharpened broomstick. We got to where they kept the prison guards, and I talked to them, you know, while we're surrounded by these other guys, and they all just said, tell our families that we're okay and just pray for us. I spent the whole night in there. In the morning, they brought us back and let us out, which was good. So the air smelled really nice. And I wrote that story, and it was really, you know, pretty dramatic story. But then, night after that, or two nights after that, first time ever, the police kept the reporters back. And I saw the prison, all the other prison guards showing up in winter clothes and in summertime, and with shields, homemade shields of wood or some tabletops is all I remember. And then a police car came up and gave them, they had, a lot of them had baseball bats, but they had opened the trunk of one or more police cars and were filled with batons, with still with their cellophane wrappings on them. They pulled those off, and you know, the baton is, it's hickory wood, but most of all, it's got lead on the inside. So if you get hit by that, whatever it hits, it'll break and hurt a lot. So I went inside a warehouse across the street from the prison and climbed up and up and up. And I could see over the wall of the prison. I saw the prison guards go in, and I heard a lot of screams. Guards came out. They were dragging prisoners with them, and they had this two rows of guards on a loading platform, and they made the prisoners walk between them and beat them, just beat them. No, couldn't blame them. These two guys had taken over, taken their friends. They beat their prisoners until they were broken. There was nothing left. And they dropped them over the side of this loading platform until their bodies piled up to the height of the platform, which is 4 or 5, 6 feet, not 6 feet, about 5 feet off the ground, back of the size of a truck. And I'm watching all this and thinking, there's no cell phones, there's no cameras, there's no nothing. I went downstairs later, and the mayor, John Lindsay, he was the famous New York mayor, who was kind of like the Kennedy of the city, and he was having a press conference saying the guards are taking control and there's no retaliation. And I'm in the back and I said, that's not true. So a whole bunch of cameras and microphones turned on me, and I said what I saw.
Executives from the Daily News were, at first, reluctant to run such a sensational and controversial story by a young reporter. Then, somebody dropped a bunch of pictures on the photo desk. Unbeknownst to McArdle, a photographer from the Associated Press was one floor above him in the jail, taking photos of everything he saw as the riot unfolded. The story hit the streets, and McArdle became famous in the Big Apple. A grand jury even indicted several guards based on McArdle's story. On his way out of journalism, Mike has simple advice for those who are entering. Avoid press releases and avoid spokespeople, and follow your passion to tell stories.
Well, if you want to do it, do it. You know, if you want to write, you want to be a writer, well, then write. You want to be a reporter, then report. Find any story that you are interested in and make yourself, and just do it. Just learn about it, meet people. Write about them, and it can still be crime or peace and love. It can still be science or medicine or botany or everything. And do what you're doing with the podcast. You have stories everywhere, and just it's not easy, but it's not, never really been easy. Better you get. Or you'll get published, even if you think it's hopeless. It's not. People, you can do books, you can do, podcasts again, and other stuff that I don't know the names of, but the internet's full of information. And just take a lot of pictures. Pictures are great. You don't have to read them.
Thank you for the stories, Mike. We'll miss you. News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, China pays Taiwan influencers to film positive videos in Xinjiang. China reportedly wants to diminish negative narratives about its control of the region. Taiwanese YouTuber Potter King revealed in June that China had invited influencers to travel and film videos in Xinjiang. A second group of internet celebrities is reportedly set to travel to Xinjiang to tout its local environment and public security. China's Taiwan Affairs Office hosted a delegation of Taiwanese business people in August in Xinjiang to promote investment and development. In ABC News Australia, former drug traffickers reveal their methods to import meth and cocaine into the Pacific as authorities look to turn the tide on smuggling. Experts say drug cartels and outlaw motorcycle gangs are now targeting nations such as Tonga and neighboring island countries Fiji and Samoa to import huge amounts of methamphetamine and cocaine. They are bringing drugs into the Pacific, using these countries as transit points as they attempt to smuggle product into the huge, lucrative markets of Australia and New Zealand. In Kyoto news, China's Xi vows $50 billion of aid for Africa to modernize Global South. In the previous summit of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation in 2018, the Chinese leader vowed to extend $60 billion of financing to Africa. Observers say China is keen to promote unity within African nations and other countries in the Global South as part of its efforts to establish alternative institutions for global governance to those led by the West.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, there is a gulf between the tasks that Portlanders value highest and the ones they think the city does best. A survey conducted in May offers a clue why so many residents are dissatisfied. Oregon Values and Benefits Center found 55% of Portlanders surveyed said they felt the city was on the wrong track, while 27% thought it was moving in the right direction. While 89% of respondents ranked streets, sidewalks, and transportation as the most important service the city provides, it was the top choice. Only 30% of respondents thought the quality of that service was acceptable. In Crosscut, all Seattle Public Library services were restored after May cyber attack. The public can now access public computers and all services that had been unavailable since the attack on Memorial Day. Other restored services include Wi-Fi, printing, the online catalog, ebooks, and audiobooks. The library is also allowing people to return their books and other physical materials after asking patrons to hold onto them during the outage. And in the Breaker.News, read stories about the latest on the North Shore wastewater treatment plant scandal and Conservative leader John Rustad's ideas to reform BC's broken freedom of information system. In the Breaker.News.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Parkinson Society British Columbia, which advocates for and assists people living in BC who are living with the neurodegenerative disorder. The first weekend after Labor Day weekend is the annual Parkinson Super Walk. Find out how you can donate. Go to parkinson.bc.ca.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 8th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 8th of September in 1979, the Vancouver Whitecaps won the North American Soccer League's Soccer Bowl, a 2-1 win over the Tampa Bay Rowdies at Giants Stadium in New Jersey? The Tony Waiters-coached Whitecaps included stars of the 60s and 70s from England and Canadians who would eventually play in the Mexico 1986 World Cup. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.